Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 993. Update on Ukraine, subtitled Preparations for World War III? This is being recorded on January 23rd of 2018. As indicated by the title of the show, we are going to be bringing up to date a number of different aspects of the story of the Ukraine crisis. And in particular, we're going to look at a constellation of developments and of individuals and institutions which, taken together, are very ominous indeed. There may very well be, as I speak on January 23rd of 2018, preparations underway for a third world war. And while those preparations may not be as deliberate and preconceived in some corners of our government and our national security establishment, and in some corners of other countries' governments and national security establishments, I think that with a failed state in Ukraine, and that's what that benighted country is, it's been a failed state pretty much since it separated from the former Soviet Union. The dissatisfaction with the Yanukovych government, which was channeled and manifested as a covert operation / coup d'etat, was in and of itself very real. Yanukovych was corrupt. His government was corrupt and incompetent. And in that regard, was both a continuation of previous Ukrainian governments of various kinds, including many that flowed into the tributaries of the Maidan coup of 2014 that brought a number of OUNB successor organizations to power in Ukraine. And the Yanukovych government was very much a precedent for the corruption and the incompetence and the indebtedness and resulting unpopularity, extreme unpopularity of Petro Poroshenko, the current Ukrainian president. I would note that Poroshenko was Yanukovych's finance minister, and not exactly an individual whose credentials would suggest that he would be the person to right the economic wrongs and imbalances of the Yanukovych regime and all of the regimes that preceded Yanukovych. The point being that the bloom is very much off the Poroshenko blossom, and Ukraine is basically being seen around the world, including by some very powerful economic institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, as the failed state that it quite obviously is. We will be taking a look at how rampant corruption by Poroshenko and the perpetually dominant oligarchs in Ukraine, of whom Poroshenko is one, how that is feeding dissatisfaction among the Ukrainian population, and how the continued corruption also is basically highlighting just what a bad government Poroshenko has presided over in Ukraine. A key point here is that with Ukraine basically failing and falling apart, something that would not only save Poroshenko's regime as a whole, but which would distract attention from troubles here in the U.S., troubles having to do with Donald Trump and various things relating to Trump and the Republican Party in general, having a war or at the very least a heightened conflict in the Donbass region and deepening involvement by the U.S. in Ukraine and saber-rattling, perhaps, who knows, leading to a wider war involving Russia and NATO and or the U.S. That would certainly take attention away from Poroshenko and the pressure off of Poroshenko and the oligarchs and some of the elements related to the OUNB, Nazi slash fascist successor organizations in Ukraine, who are not at all free from the taint of corruption. War and or the threat of war is always a very good way of deflecting attention away from domestic shortcomings and focusing people's dissatisfaction and anger on a, quote, foreign, unquote, enemy. And we're going to be taking a look at that and some obvious and very ominous indications that forces here in the U.S. are collaborating or at the very least giving momentum to and assisting the drift toward war, and that may be a very optimistic term, in Ukraine. We will go into some of the corruption, including corruption manifested by the son of Arsen Avakov, of Arsen, hang on one second, he is the interior minister of the Ukraine, and he is someone who is very much involved with the corruption that is currently overtaking Ukraine. Yes, it's Arsen Avakov's son. Avakov is the interior minister of Ukraine, and he presides over the Azov Battalion, a Nazi combatant unit in Ukraine that flies not only the SS rune but the swastika on their combat helmets. Some correction, by the way. And for the record, 982, titled Manafort and the Snipers, I misidentified some of the apparent fascist snipers who appear to have manipulated the Maidan demonstrations in the direction of a violent provocation. I misidentified them as members of the Azov Battalion. At the time that they were engaged in those activities, the Azov Battalion had not yet been formed. Many of them, such as Michael Skillet, ultimately became members of the Azov Battalion. However, at that point in time, the Azov Battalion had not become a political and military reality. With the Russiagate PSYOP, and we have in many programs, including, for the record, 943, 965, 967, 981, and 982, taking a look at how the Russiagate PSYOP really has some very profound Ukrainian fascist foundations. We're going to talk more about that. And as we contemplate a drift of events in the direction of a possible ignition point for World War III, taking stock of what happened at Maidan, the increasingly strong probability that that was, in fact, a provocation, and noting not only the experience with but the skill of some of the OUNB successor organizations such as Svoboda and Pravi Sektor, the Azov Battalion, and people and institutions associated with them, the possibility that another provocation could be staged to light the match to World War III is one to be very seriously considered here. We're going to begin by taking a look at something that has been eclipsed by the Russiagate PSYOP. There has been quite apart from no coverage of what is going on in Russia or what the Russians are saying with regard to Ukraine or other things, but really it simply has not come into discussion in the U.S. at all.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
A very important article in Consortium News of January 21st of 2018 by Gilbert Doctorow, D-O-C-T-O-R-O-W, called A Coming Russia-Ukraine War, focuses attention on some developments in Ukraine that have not received much coverage at all in the U.S. and perhaps of the rest of the West as well. I don't know. Certainly not in the U.S. From A Coming Russia-Ukraine War by Gilbert Doctorow, again, Consortium News of January 21st of 2018. Introduction. A new draft law adopted by the Ukrainian parliament and awaiting President Petro Poroshenko's signature threatens to escalate the Ukrainian conflict into a full-blown war, pitting nuclear-armed Russia against the United States and NATO, reports Gilbert Doctorow. Skipping down. Then, this past Thursday came a wholly new development. A draft law passed by the Ukrainian parliament that could effectively end Kiev's participation in the conflict resolution process known as the Minsk Accords. Although observers in the U.S. and Western Europe may have missed it, many Russians believe this development amounts to a declaration of war by the government of Ukraine. This last sentence again. Although observers in the U.S. and Western Europe may have missed it, many Russians believe this development amounts to a declaration of war by the government of Ukraine. Dmitry Kiselyov, K-I-S-E-L-Y-O-V, head of all Russian television and radio news services, offered a sober analysis of the emotionally charged development on his Sunday evening news wrap-up today. According to Kiselyov, the new law, which awaits Poroshenko's signature, makes preparation for war and includes language indicating a bellicose new approach to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. The mission in Donbass is no longer described as a, quote, anti-terrorist operation, unquote. Rather, the mission now is to send armed forces against, quote, military formations of the Russian Federation, unquote, in Donbass. Military headquarters are established to coordinate the operation to be waged in Donbass. While up until now, the self-declared republics of Donetsk and Lugansk, that's D-O-N-E-T-S-K as in kangaroo, and L-U-G-A-N-S-K as in kangaroo, were considered under the Minsk Peace Accords as negotiating parties. Now, they are only, quote, occupation administrations, unquote, of the Russian Federation on these territories, with Russia identified as, unquote, aggressor, unquote. Quote, this makes it all the more convenient for Ukraine to start a war, unquote, Kiselyov says, noting that it could have the added benefit of enabling Ukraine not to pay its foreign debts and to ensure Poroshenko's continued grip on power. A Vesti reporter on the ground in Donetsk confirmed with local residents their view that the law means war. They see the current moment on the front line as, quote, the calm before the storm, unquote. Donetsk soldiers at their trenches say they are fully ready to engage with the enemy. While Kiselyov acknowledges that the draft law might not ultimately be implemented, it nevertheless reveals a growing mood in the Ukrainian capital in favor of military escalation. The facts speak for themselves, Kosselyov says. With Poroshenko failing to adhere to the Minsk Accords, for example, by organizing local elections in Donbass, he did not do that, or to observe ceasefires along the lines of contact. There are attacks and deaths every day, and only counterforces have pushed back recent Ukrainian attempts to gain territory. Kiev has seemingly written off the population of the two self-proclaimed republics, cutting off all transport and telecommunications links and failing to pay pensions and assistance to the needy. It closed the banking system, and there are no commercial ties. For Kiev, the two provinces are merely territory to take back from the occupiers, with the well-being of the local populations at best a secondary concern. On the economic front, the European Union has refused to extend 600 million euros of credit due, beginning again. On the economic front, the European Union has refused to extend 600 million euros of credit to Ukraine due to that country's corruption. The International Monetary Fund recently refused a tranche of $800 million over failure to introduce reforms by the Poroshenko government. Meanwhile, in 2019, Ukraine is due to start repaying earlier loans. This will come to $14 billion a year, which amounts to half the state budget of Ukraine. Due to dire economic conditions, Poroshenko and other government officials in Kiev have become deeply unpopular and, with diminished chances for electoral success, may see war as politically advantageous. And although there are indications that some Western leaders are fed up with Kiev, the U.S. has doubled down in its support for a military solution to the conflict. With military trainers now on the ground and the U.S. budgeting $350 million for security assistance to Ukraine, Washington has also recently started delivering lethal weapons, including the Javelin anti-tank missile system, free of charge to Kiev. In contrast to the image of the Trump administration policies as being dictated by Moscow, as portrayed by proponents of Russiagate conspiracy theories, the U.S. is instead moving towards deeper confrontation with the Kremlin in the geopolitical hotspot of Ukraine. For its part, the Kremlin has very little to gain and a great deal to lose economically and diplomatically from a campaign now against Kiev. If successful, as likely would be the case given the vast disparity in military potential of the two sides, it could easily become a Pyrrhic victory for Russia. But notwithstanding Kosselyov's reassuring words on his Sunday evening wrap-up, it may well be the case that Moscow feels it has no choice but to act militarily. Moves by Kiev to exacerbate the conflict must be quickly countered to prevent deeper intervention by the U.S. and its NATO allies and prevent the conditions for World War III from taking hold. The last sentence again. Moves by Kiev to exacerbate the conflict must be quickly countered to prevent deeper intervention by the U.S. and its NATO allies and prevent the conditions for World War III from taking hold. Well, we're going to take a look at U.S. arming of Ukraine. I have noted in the past that we have been training and offering some military assistance to military forces in Ukraine initially, and we're going to take a look at we're going to review some of that. Some of the Nazi formations, such as the aforementioned Azov Battalion, were forbidden or proscribed from receiving U.S. military aid and training, but that was reversed by a December 2016 executive order, or basically in one of the last acts of the Obama administration. Obama signed a congressional law permitting the circumvention of a congressional resolution against the training and arming of Nazi formations in Ukraine. More about that later. We have been sending not only anti-sniper technology, but also anti-tank Javelin missiles, as indicated in that article. And there are now proposals to send anti-aircraft weaponry to the Ukrainian forces fighting in or near to and or fighting in eastern Ukraine. That is interesting because neither of the rebel forces in Donetsk or Luhansk have aircraft. They have no air force. Russia, of course, does. Some discussion has maintained that what we are going to be providing them with are Stinger missiles specifically designed or engineered, re-engineered to shoot down drone aircraft. And apparently the military forces in Luhansk and Donetsk do have drones. Traditionally or historically, keeping Stinger missiles out of the hands of elements that have engaged in terrorist activity has been a high priority for the U.S. national security establishment. Certainly, elements of the Ukrainian military are Nazi and have shown a penchant for provocation. Putting weapons like that into their hands may very well be something of a license for them to engage in more provocative activity. Very quickly, about the Trump administration sending arms to Ukraine from Newsweek of December 26th of 2017, an article by John Haltwanger, or Haltwanger, H-A-L-T-I-W-A-N-G-E-R. Trump sends tank-killing missile to fight Russia in Ukraine, but what can it do? The Trump administration approved the sale of anti-tank missiles to Ukraine on Friday as it continues to fight pro-Russian forces in the eastern part of the country, a move that has angered the Kremlin and signifies the U.S. government's escalating involvement in the conflict. The decision to sell the Javelin missiles also comes not long after the Trump administration approved a limited weapons sale between American manufacturers and Ukraine of model M107A1 sniper systems, ammunition, and associated equipment. Quote, "The U.S. has decided to provide Ukraine enhanced defensive capabilities as part of our effort to help Ukraine build its long-term defense capacity to defend its sovereignty and territorial integrity and to deter further aggression," U.S. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert, N-A-U-E-R-T, told the Wall Street Journal on Friday. And still more about the arming of Ukraine. This from the New York Times of August 1st of 2017 by Eric Schmidt and Andrew E. Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R. Pentagon and State Department said to propose arming Ukraine. The Pentagon and State Department have proposed to the White House a plan to supply Ukraine with anti-tank missiles and other arms, according to Defense Department officials. The proposed transfer, which also would include anti-aircraft arms that will be defined as defensive weaponry, comes as fighting between Ukrainian troops and Russian-backed separatists has increased in recent days, and the United States is taking steps to deter aggressive military actions by Moscow. And skipping down. Under the new proposal, which was reported earlier by the Wall Street Journal, the administration will provide anti-tank weapons, most likely Javelin missiles, as well as possibly anti-aircraft weapons, in addition to other arms. Ukraine has long sought Javelins to counter Russian-made armored vehicles in rebel-held areas. And skipping down again, The utility of anti-aircraft weaponry, for example, is unclear, as the Russian-backed rebel army has no air force. The war is fought along a line of trenches that has not moved much since February of 2015. Well, the rebel army has no air force. Russia, however, does. We are being told that the altered or re-engineered Stinger missiles are for use against drones by the rebel forces. Now, that remains to be determined. Now, this is against the background of a new tough-minded Trump administration point man in Ukraine. That man's name is Kurt, spelled K-U-R-T. His last name is Volker, or Volker, V-O-L-K-E-R. Both names spelled as one would in Germany, although Volker would probably possibly have a C before the K. But then the man's name, Kurt, K-U-R-T, Volker, V-O-L-K-E-R, from the very conservative and defense-oriented publication, The National Interest, of July 10th of 2017, by Kurt Mills, M-I-L-L-S. Can Kurt Volker solve the Ukraine crisis? It reads in part, as Donald Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Hamburg late last week, his State Department announced the appointment of a tough-minded former NATO ambassador to serve as Washington's new point man on Ukraine. His mandate is to help implement the Minsk agreements. I would take that with a grain of salt, parenthetically. Kurt Volker is widely respected as an accomplished diplomat, but in Ukraine, he confronts his greatest challenge yet. And skipping down some of the major points of Kurt Volker's CV. Although he may be seen as hawkish by the Russian side, he will certainly be taken seriously, says Matthew Rojansky, R-O-J-A-N-S-K-Y, director of the Kenan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center of this new special representative for Ukraine negotiations, whose vaunted resume also includes stints with the National Security Council, CIA, and Foreign Service. More about the background of the Trump administration's point man for Ukraine, Kurt Volker, from Kurt Volker's Wikipedia entry. Volker began his career in foreign affairs as an analyst at the CIA in 1986. That was during, of course, Ronald Reagan's second administration, when William Casey was still director of CIA, and George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named, was vice president. In 1988, Volker joined the U.S. Department of State as a foreign service officer in the U.S. Foreign Service. And then more about his various postings, skipping down. He then became acting director for European and Eurasian Affairs for the National Security Council. In that capacity, he was in charge of U.S. preparations for the 2004 Istanbul Summit of NATO members and the 2002 Prague Summit. In July of 2005, Volker became George W. Bush's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, and served in that position until he was appointed U.S. Permanent Representative to NATO in July of 2008 by President George W. Bush. And skipping down more about Kurt Volker's CV credits. He has been a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations, Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and since September of 2009, and a senior advisor at the Atlantic Council since October of 2009. Well, in addition to all of his CIA and NATO postings, note that Kurt Volker is a senior advisor to the Atlantic Council. Reviewing very briefly from an article from The Nation magazine of January 3rd of 2017 by James Carden, capital Carben, is skepticism treason, unquote. In For the Record 943, among other publications, we noted that much of the, quote, evidence, unquote, of Russian hacking of the U.S. election has come from a company called CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity outfit, and the co-founder and chief technology officer of CrowdStrike is a guy named Dmitry Alperovich, Dmitry Alperovich, from James Carden's Nation article from January of 2017. In this respect, it is worth noting that one of the commercial cybersecurity companies the government has relied on in the Russiagate operation is CrowdStrike, which was one of the companies initially brought in by the DNC to investigate the alleged hacks. Dmitry Alperovich, or Alperovich, is also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Kurt Volker is a senior advisor at the Atlantic Council. Beginning again, Dmitry Alperovich is also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. The connection between CrowdStrike co-founder and chief technology officer Dmitry Alperovich and the Atlantic Council has gone largely unremarked upon. But it is relevant given that the Atlantic Council, which is funded in part by, and listen to this, the U.S. State Department, NATO, the governments of Latvia and Lithuania, the Ukrainian World Congress, and the Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk, has been among the loudest voices calling for a new Cold War with Russia. As I pointed out in the pages of The Nation in November, the Atlantic Council has spent the past several years producing some of the most virulent specimens of the new Cold War propaganda. And by the way, Viktor Pinchuk has helped to finance the aforementioned Nazi Azov Battalion as well. So again, note that among the many interesting CV credits of Kurt Volker is his affiliation with the Atlantic Council, and Dmitry Alperovich is also deeply involved with the Atlantic Council, which has NATO, the State Department, the Ukrainian World Congress very closely allied with the OUNB successor organizations that have come to power in Ukraine. The Atlantic Council, a common element for both CrowdStrike and Kurt Volker, who has been presiding over the weapon sales to Ukraine, or weapons transfers to Ukraine. This as the Poroshenko government is poised to sign legislation which would basically scrap the Minsk Accords and very well, very possibly set the stage for World War III. Now, as all of these things are taking place, a key congressional opponent of arming, among other elements, the Nazi Azov Battalion has been removed. And in the following article, we're not only going to, this was written by a guy named Christopher, K-R-I-S-T-O-F-E-R, Harrison, H-A-R-R-I-S-O-N. He had been someone affiliated with both the Defense Department and the State Department under George W. Bush, a similar background to Kurt Volker. And this describes John Conyers, up until recently the oldest and longest serving member of the House of Representatives and one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus. John Conyers had been one of the most vocal and high-profile critics of the arming and training of Nazi elements in Ukraine, such as the aforementioned Azov Battalion. The article labels him, again, this from the Huffington Post of August 7th of 2015. This Christopher Harrison article, frankly, in effect, if not literally libelous, calls John Conyers Putin's man in Congress. This is neo-McCarthyism at its worst. And note that the spokesperson for the Azov Battalion is none other than Roman Zvarych. That's R-O-M-A-N-Z-V-A-R-Y-C-H. You also see that as S-V-A-R-Y-C-H, depending on the transliteration from the Cyrillic alphabet. He was, Zvarych, that is, was the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko, the World War II OUNB puppet head of Ukraine, who collaborated with and implemented Nazi ethnic cleansing operations in Ukraine. Zvarych became Stetsko's personal secretary in the early 1980s. He then founded the Our Ukraine Party, co-founded it with Slava Stetsko, Yaroslav Stetsko's widow. He became justice minister, the equivalent of attorney general, under the government of Viktor Yushchenko after the Orange Revolution, which could be thought of as Maidan I, and saw many of the same OUNB successor organizations and individuals put in power in Ukraine, or then turned out, and have now been returned to power. Zvarych also was justice minister under both Tymoshenko governments and is an advisor to Petro Poroshenko and the key spokesperson for the Nazi Azov Battalion, again, who fly the swastika and the SS rune, the death rune, on their combat helmets.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Again, from the Huffington Post of August 7th, 2017, by Christopher Harrison, former Defense Department and State Department aide to George W. Bush, Putin's man in Congress. The Azov's spokesman, skipping down, Roman Zvarych, told me the battalion has a selective screening program that accepts only 50 out of almost 300 recruits each month. Representative John Conyers played an important role in helping the Russian Nazi meme evolve from the stuff of conspiracy theorists, kooks, and fellow travelers into something the mainstream press happily prints. Representative Conyers took to the floor of the House to submit his amendment and labeled the unit, quote, the repulsive neo-Nazi Azov Battalion, unquote. From there, the Daily Beast ran the story, is America training neo-Nazis in Ukraine, and using Conyers' bill as factual support. The day after the amendment's passage, Leonid Bershinsky ran a Bloomberg View article titled, Ukraine's Neo-Nazis Won't Get U.S. Money, unquote. Even the Canadians have been affected. On June 16th, the National Post ran a story titled, Fears That Canadian Mission in Ukraine May Unintentionally Help Neo-Nazi Groups. Well, John Conyers is no longer in Congress. He fell before the hashtag MeToo phenomenon. And I would note Conyers is old. He is 88 years of age. He settled out of court with a woman who was alleging sexual harassment. And he claims that basically he simply did not want to run up the expense of long litigation. And litigation is extremely expensive. And also very stressful at his age, at the age of 88, rather than go through a long raking over on the coals experience, whether or not he won. It does not surprise me that Conyers simply bowed out of Congress. But what is worth noting here is how the, quote, hashtag Me Too tarring of John Conyers. Again, arguably the leading congressional opponent of arming the Nazi Azov Battalion. Now, by the way, receiving U.S. arms and training. John Conyers was ousted via the hashtag MeToo phenomenon. And some interesting detail about how that happened from the New York Times of December 31st of 2017. An article by Kenneth P. Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. Partisans wielding money begin seeking to exploit harassment claims. In November, the Trump-backing social media agitator Mike Cernovich, C-E-R-N-O-V-I-C-H, offered to pay $10,000 for details of any congressional sexual harassment settlements and said on Twitter that he would cover the expenses of any victim of a congressman who wants to come forward to tell her story. Shortly before posting that offer, a source provided Mr. Cernovich with a copy of a sexual harassment settlement that led in December to the resignation of Representative John Conyers, Jr., Democrat of Michigan, until then the longest-serving member of the House, and it was in December of 2016 that about a year prior to this, that moves to arm the Azov Battalion had begun. Continuing. "You've got to sweeten the pot a little bit," Mr. Cernovich said. A lawyer by training, he said he was shocked that the person who gave him the Conyers documents declined his offer to pay for them. But he said, "If somebody had a settlement like Conyers, I would gladly, gladly pay for that." Skipping down, Mr. Cernovich and the far-right activist Charles C. Johnson had to back away from claims that they possessed a sexual harassment settlement that would bring down a leading Democratic senator when it became apparent that the document which targeted the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York was a forgery, lifting passages verbatim from the Conyers complaint unearthed by Mr. Cernovich. Mr. Schumer referred the matter to the Capitol Hill police for a criminal investigation. Quote, "I like to hype things in advance, and this looked pretty good," Mr. Cernovich said. "I definitely learned my lesson there." Mr. Cernovich is an unlikely champion for sexual harassment victims, given his previous career as an anti-feminist blogger who cast doubt on date rape allegations and wrote posts with headlines like, "Misogyny Gets You Laid," unquote. Yeah, he is an unlikely champion for sexual harassment victims. He offered money to any victim of a congressman and was not paid, according to him, for the information about Conyers. Do note, however, that financial incentive was offered for information like that after the out-of-court settlement by the team Conyers or Conyers legal people became public. A number of anonymous accusers of John Conyers came forward, and John Conyers bowed out, with the origins for the removal of, quote, "Putin's man in Congress," unquote, the most high-profile member of Congress to criticize the arming of the Nazi Azov Battalion, with that coming from a far-right blogger, Mike Cernovich, identified with what I call the Trumpen Kampfverband of the Trump administration. I think it raises some very disturbing questions about the exit of John Conyers. Along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website, the blog GermanForeignPolicy.com revolves. And in November of this, of last year, rather 2017, they had two articles which both spoke about the corruption, the economic failure, and the participation of the son of the Ukrainian Interior Minister Arsen Avakov in some of the corruption in Ukraine. That corruption is being covered up. The oligarchs are as much in charge as ever. And the economy is disintegrating. And I think the growing incentive for not only Poroshenko, but Ukraine's apologists abroad, including the U.S., to start a third world war, which might only begin as escalation in eastern Ukraine. It could escalate not unlike the flashpoints of the First World War. It could escalate into a nuclear conflict.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
From GermanForeignPolicy.com of November 24th of 2017, there is an article, Sowing Chaos 1, and it reads in part, 4 years after the beginning of the Maidan protests, serious accusations are being leveled against leading activists of the pro-Western opponents of the reigning government at the time. Three ethnic Georgians who incriminate themselves by their own participation had told the Italian media that the Maidan snipers, who had unleashed the February 20, 2013 Maidan massacre, had allegedly been acting under orders and with the practical support of the opposition. I would note in For the Record 982, we looked at some very serious allegations that Paul Manafort had helped to initiate the sniper fire in Maidan. It was that sniper fire that led to the downfall of Yanukovych. Continuing, the statements of the snipers confirm the confessions made earlier, some even in public, by other snipers. There has been no reaction from Ukrainian authorities. While Kiev is marking the fourth anniversary of the beginning of the protests this week, more than three-fourths of the population sees their country as plunged into ruin and chaos, according to a poll. The power of the Ukrainian oligarchs is still intact, and corruption is becoming rampant. Only anti-Russian measures are being successfully executed, including those massively limiting freedom of the press for Ukraine's sizable Russian minority. 4 years after the beginning of the Maidan protests on November 21, 2013, the abuses which had provoked the demonstrations are still prevalent throughout the country, which is now oriented toward the West. The power of the oligarchs at that time is still intact. Already 1 year ago, experts noted that even though there have been some reshuffles among diverse factions of the oligarchs, it does not change the fact that they are still largely controlling Kiev's politics. This has been confirmed by recent studies. The last two decades have shown, quote, that the periodical changes of political regime in Ukraine have had merely a limited effect on the oligarchic system, unquote, according to the authors of an analysis by the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, or SIDA. Even after the February 2014 push, oligarchs are still in control, quote, of strategic branches of the economy. For example, around 80% of the Ukrainian television market, where there has not been much change, unquote, notes the Brussels think tank Bruegel, the political influence of some oligarchs has increased even further. In fact, since 2014, an oligarch is officially leading the country, President Petro Poroshenko. Corruption continues at high levels. For example, the case of Interior Minister Arsen Avakov's son, who sold backpacks to the army at six times their normal price, allegedly causing damage in the six-digit euros. When the National Anti-Corruption Bureau searched the man's house, the National Guard, under the responsibility of the Interior Minister, intervened and halted the search under the pretext of having to vacate the building because of a bomb threat. Arsen Avakov is the interior minister of Ukraine, the National Guard, which includes units like the Azov Battalion and other, quote, Punisher, unquote, battalions, are under his jurisdiction. His son apparently sold backpacks to the army at 6 times their normal price, allegedly causing damage in the 6-digit euros. However, the National Guard intervened and prevented any meaningful investigation of his situation. Now, remember, again, as we looked at in For the Record 982, Paul Manafort appears to have initiated the sniper fire in the Maidan. Well, certainly there are indications that he initiated the sniper fire in Maidan, and increasingly that is looking like a provocation. Skipping down. In February of 2016, Maidan activist Ivan Bubenchik, B-U-B-E-N-C-H-I-K, confessed that in the course of the Maidan massacre, he had shot Ukrainian police officers. Bubenchik confirmed this in a film that had attracted international attention. Last week, the Italian daily Il Giornale, as well as the Canale 5, or Channel 5 television channel, published a report revealing more details. Three Georgians reported that on the day of the shooting, they too had been employed by the opponents of the government at the time as snipers. They say that they had been explicitly ordered to shoot at both policemen and demonstrators to, quote, sow chaos, unquote. If this is true, the official narrative also propagated by the government in Berlin that the Ukrainian government's repressive forces had deliberately committed the February 20th massacre caves in. Equally grave is the fact that the three Georgians are not only heavily implicated themselves, but their testimonies substantiate grave suspicions around some of the influential politicians in the current pro-Western Ukraine. And more about this from Sowing Chaos 2, this from GermanForeignPolicy.com of November 27th of 2017. In an Italian TV documentary on February 20th of 2014, the Maidan massacre, in an Italian TV documentary on the February 20th, 2014 Maidan massacre, serious accusations were made against several politicians in Ukraine, including influential politicians who are Germany's cooperation partners. In the documentary, three Georgians incriminating themselves for their own participation report that some of the leaders of the protests, who are today members of Kiev's parliament, had supplied weapons to the snipers who at the time indiscriminately killed policemen and demonstrators. Officially, this massacre is still being attributed to Ukrainian repressive organs or to unspecified Russians. The Georgians also report that the current Speaker of the Parliament, Andrei Parubly, was often seen in the hotel from where the snipers were firing that day. As commander of the Maidan, unquote, Parubly had been in charge of controlling armed gangs on that square. The man, whose real role at the time remains unclear, was a guest at a conference held by the Konrad Adenauer Foundation and a speaker at NATO events. And I would note here that the UNA-UNSO, one of the permutations of the UPA, the military cadre of the OUNB, which in the World War II period gave rise to formations like the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall or Nachtigall Battalion and the Galician Division, the 14th Waffen-SS Division. The UPA, also as the UNA-UNSO, after the fall of the Soviet Union, had participated in, among other conflicts, the Chechen conflict and in the Georgian War of 2008 and 2009. Andrei Parubly, the founder of the Social National Party of Ukraine, a key member of Svoboda and the commander of the Maidan. And bear in mind what we looked at in, For the Record, 982, the very real possibility that Paul Manafort, far from being a Russian dupe, was actually a penetration agent and helped to spur the sniper fire and the resulting exit of Yanukovych. Skipping down to Georgians, accusations also implicate, at least indirectly, the commander of the Maidan, Andrei Parubiy. Parubiy comes from the Ukrainian fascist scene. In the early 1990s, he was one of the founders of the extreme right Social National Party of Ukraine. Since 1996, he was the leader of its militarist street fighting subsidiary Patriot of Ukraine, unquote. Following his retirement from the party, this experienced protest activist became one of the main organizers of the 2004 Orange Revolution. We've seen how Yushchenko brought in many of the same OUNB successor organizations and individuals who have also played a key part in the Poroshenko government. In 2013, Parubiy assumed the same function at the Maidan, where he was responsible for none other than security and the, quote, self-defense units, unquote, which were often made up of heavily armed thugs. In the Italian TV documentary, it was reported that Parubiy was going in and out of Hotel Ukraina, from where numerous deadly shots were being fired. Parubiy claims that the hotel from which these shots were being fired, which was firmly under the Maidan demonstrators' control, had been taken over, quote, by snipers who arrived from Russia and who were controlled by Russia, unquote. Parubiy, who according to former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden was conferring with the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, throughout the upheavals almost on an hourly basis, has never really had his role in the putsch explained. And again, the role of Andrei Parubiy and these snipers from Georgia has yet to be properly explored. And I think that in light of what is going on with the arming of Ukraine under Kurt Volker, and with Ukraine now having reclassified the conflict in the eastern part of the country as basically a foreign occupation by Russia, the possibilities of some of these same dynamics of provocation could lead basically to the end of the world. We noted earlier the Atlantic Council, something that both Kurt Volker and Dmitry Alperovitch of CrowdStrike have in common, and its strong links to the State Department, NATO, and to the OUNB successor organizations, Milieu. Note the following, again, from Politico of July 11th of 2017, rather, by Ben Schreckinger, S-C-H-R-E-C-K-I-N-G-E-R. GOP researcher who sought Clinton emails had alt-right help. This also can be considered in combination with Mike Cernovich and his role in removing John Conyers. Talking about attempts at getting a hold of Hillary Clinton's emails by one Peter Smith. Smith's activist, the journalist turned entrepreneur Charles Johnson, and his former business partner Pax Dickinson also agreed to help Smith's quixotic mission. Smith also reached out to Guccifer 2.0, an alias the U.S. intelligence community has linked to Russian state hackers, and was advised to seek the help of a white nationalist hacker who lives in Ukraine. Johnson said he also suggested that Smith get in touch with Andrew Arenheimer, a hacker who goes by the alias Weave and has collaborated with Johnson in the past. So again, the possible role of Andrew Arenheimer with the hacking of the DNC and obtaining Hillary's emails, etc., is something that is very much up in the air. I'm also including an article about more fake news coming out of Ukraine and their attempts at rewriting the history of World War II. From the Defending History blog of January 11th of 2018, more fake news again from Ukraine and once more about the Holocaust. And this is talking about Ukraine using pictures allegedly showing KGB or NKVD Soviet atrocities against the Ukrainian population, but these are actually photos taken from World War II, which show basically Jewish victims being seriously inconvenienced by Nazi occupation collaborationist forces. However, this is in the written description for the record 993. This concludes For the Record 993, update on Ukraine preparations for World War III, question mark. This is being recorded on January 23rd of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.